So, Kara Bird, tell me, what attracted you to Imagine Durant?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with making change. You know, as a millennial myself, just by a couple of years, that's one of the things that I think that we always want to do is we want to make this place better than we found it. And I think that was one of the biggest things is I had the opportunity to not just make change for my life, but also to make change for my community and those that live here and then the future generations that are going to be living here.
And what kind of an impact did you think you would have in making that kind of change?
You know, that's a very hard question to answer because with this being such a new organization and a new process, you have ideas that you might see changing in the housing or the quality of life, but you really don't know until you start the work and you start moving things forward. So I'd love to tell you that I had a very concrete idea of what those changes would look like, but as you know, in a visioning process and going through things, you're really not 100% sure what those changes will be.
Exactly. I think that's fair to understand. But you had a very interesting background, I know, because I was on the recruitment team. And I thought that you might like to tell us a little bit about how that might have influenced you to take the job and what you've actually can bring forward from what you were practicing and learning there.
Absolutely. So my previous job was working as a tobacco settlement endowment trust here in the States, coordinator for Atoka and Cole counties. And so my job was working with public and private entities to pass tobacco regulation policy. So I worked a lot with city councils and school councils to pass non-tobacco use ordinances, if you will. And I also worked with youth to teach them to be advocates against the tobacco industry. So I think having that background right out of college and moving into the public and private sector really helped because with this job, when you're going through something like the visioning process and you're trying to include the entire community, that job set me up to be able to know how to work with those different entities, if you will. You know, with students, I'm going to work much differently. The city council, a school board, something like that. So I think that really prepared me to be able to work with the different sectors in the community and the stakeholders that I work with now.
So you became our executive director, ED for short, right?
I did.
Yeah, and I always was impressed about how you moved into creating that role from basically scratch, right?
Yes.
There was no history for you. How would you describe your role as ED?
I think it's a balancing role, really and truly, Marilyn. Like you said, when I walked in, there was a desk and, you know, between yourself, Greg, and myself, we kind of figured out what that role was together as we moved forward. And so we're very thankful that we had some guiding help from you in that. But I think whenever you look at the role as executive director, it's really learning how to balance people, your places, what you're working on at the time. Because as an executive director in a new organization, especially, you're having to learn what kind of protocols are good for your organization. So we were really lucky. We ended up being able to come under the Chamber of Commerce's umbrella. But then within that first year, we really realized that we needed to be our own organization. So with being an executive director, it's really your job to make sure the day-to-day tasks are being accomplished, and that your goals are being worked towards, and working with your community so that because you're the executive director, you're the face of the organization. So I think that's very vital that you have to make sure the organization is in line financially and for the things that it needs, but it also has to have a face that people can relate to and bring their questions and concerns to, especially as a community, you know, development. I know we're not a community development corporation, but working towards that way, that's something that you have to have when you're having community input.
Yeah, that's really a strong consideration. And yet you can't be doing any task because you're probably asked to do way more than you could do. I've always been impressed with how you were able to articulate the purpose of Imagine Durant and shape your choices of the tasks around that. Could you share how you articulate the purpose of Imagine Durant when people ask you?
Sure. So at first, it was very hard for people to kind of grasp the concept of what we were doing with Imagining Durant because, of course, we're imagining the future of our community and of our city, and that hadn't really been done before. So when we first started, we kind of created this elevator speech, and that turned into the vision statement. So what we say is Imagine Durant is a community-based initiative for creating a unified vision for our community. And we really wanted to have that unified vision aspect because we are a nonprofit. We're not run by the city. We're not run by businesses. We are really working with all of the voices of our community. And I think, too, whenever we started talking about it, a lot of people couldn't really grasp that concept of visioning. So whenever I would talk to them, I talk about whenever they're developing their houses. You know, you don't ever just go and build a house. You usually have development plans. You know, you have a blueprint. Whenever you're working with a blueprint, you have many different sectors you're working with. You're working with your contractor, your landscaper. Of course, if you have a spouse, you have to consider their ideas. And so that was one of the first kind of concrete examples I could give that people could start understanding. Oh, you're trying to develop the plans for our community so we know where we're going. Because by default, just without it, really a plan in place. And so people were able to start understanding that concept whenever you give them that idea of what it could be.
That's a really great metaphor and very helpful. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the voices. How do you relate to the voices of the city? Why are they important and who are they?
So your voices in a city are incredibly important because what we have found in the past, if your city government creates a plan, it tends to not have buy-in from your community, and you can miss very important aspects of a plan that you would need to move your community forward. So your four voices are your citizens, which are incredibly important when you're creating a community that they want to live in, that they want to raise their children in. Your businesses, your civil societies, these are the people that are going to be, you know, your nonprofits, things like that, and then your civic managers, and those are your kind of government employees. And basically, if you have all four working together, it's really great. It's kind of like the engine of a car. You know, if one thing's not working, it's not going to go as well as you need. So when you have four voices in alignment, you know, alignment really creates movement. And so if you're not including all four voices, you're missing a gear in the cog, if you will. So it doesn't get you where you want to go.
Okay, that's a great way of putting it. And I know that the board became very important. In fact, when you came on, there really wasn't even a board with any history. How did the board get chosen the first time round? And it's now the third year that we've had the board. So give us a little history of how that's transpired from the first till now.
Well, I think what's really great about it is that this organization truly is grassroots in nature, and it started with two gentlemen having a conversation. Out of that, of course, they found New Maryland, which really helped us a lot, but then we also had a formation team, and that formation team was made up of very different aspects of our community. So we had those citizens, we had nonprofits at the table, we had businesses and city leaders, and we're very fortunate that we have the Choctaw Nation here in our community, and so they're a very big aspect that needed to be in the conversation as well. And so it really started with about a team of 6 to 11, and some of those chose to go over into the board. Others decided that they had gone as far as they needed to go in the process and still wanted to be a support but couldn't give the time needed to be part of a board. So we have 4 appointed positions on the board, and these are really important because there's not been alignment within these positions, and that's something you need to move forward. One is the president of our university we have here. I mentioned the Choctaw Nation, so the Choctaw Nation chief. We have an appointment from our Chamber of Commerce. It's usually their vice chair that will be moving into the president position because they were so instrumental in getting us started and helping us just have office space and get up and running. And then our 4th one is actually our mayor of our city. And so very huge positions within our community that need to be talking and need to have that alignment. But then we also have people that are from the nonprofit world. Our United Way director is there. So, you know, her voice is very strong with what's going on in the poverty in our community, which is an issue that needs to be addressed. We have a gentleman who also started, who's Craig Massey. He's the CEO of First United Bank, one of the biggest employers here. We have the CEO of our hospital. I think I hate to say this, but probably one of my favorite board members is Cayman Farmer. And that's because he's a college student here. And so he has the voice of the young people, and he has a different perspective than some of us that are maybe the CEOs or, you know, older. And we want to retain people like him here. So, you know, we have a very diverse board, but it's exactly the way that it needs to be for our organization to be able to move forward and include the 4 voices that we're working so hard to unite and bring together.
Well, that really gives me an idea of how you get that engine going, because mm-hmm. it sounds to me like the board has many spheres of influence that they can actually reach out and create their own impact, both as individuals as well as collectively as the board. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, very much so. Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit more about the four voices and the processes that we've used in the last little while in order to be able to bring the four voices around the vision for the city. We actually created a series of dialogues. Would you like to tell me how you approached it and what your role was in those dialogues?
So I think really the very first dialogue was a learning experience for me, because we really relied heavily on the methodologies that you had used in the past. I think that first one, my role was more and really has continued to be a connector. So my job was to find those people who were, you know, the very first ones that we do are usually our thought leaders, who are the experts on the topic in our community. So asking my board, or just having gone to the different meetings and civic groups here in the community, getting to know the people here, making sure that we had the right people in the room was really, I think, very vital to make sure that we had good dialogues that were able to capture what was needed that would become reports that we could use to create our master plan. So I see that my role really and truly within this dialogue process has been to make sure that they are set up and coordinated well, that they are well attended by the people that need to be in the room, and that there's good follow through on what happens after those dialogues, that those are published in our newspaper, put on our website, mm-hmm. so the entire community gets to actually, if they weren't able to attend, they're able to see what happened. And if they think, oh, well, you know, this is a great idea that wasn't mentioned, they know how to get a hold of me and it can be added into the dialogue process later. So in a nutshell, I really feel like I'm kind of that coordinator and connector to make sure that our community's voice is able to be heard during the dialogue process.
Yeah, I think of you very much as a catalyst. And somebody else drew a picture of, it was actually a web, right? And that you were right in the center of it.
Yes.
In a friendly way.
Yes.
And interconnecting it. Let's talk a little bit about the thought leaders that we brought together, because you mentioned that they were, quote, experts on the topic. Mm-hmm. We had three sets of topics, right? First one we looked at was the economy and the community. But we didn't just go after mm-hmm. economists or just community developers, right? We actually used the four voices to bring mm-hmm. the thought leaders together. So can you say a little bit about, you were so good at being able to figure out, well, if we were looking at the economy and the community, what voice from the citizen should we bring in? Or what voice from business? How did you manage to bring the right... And we brought together about 24 people for each of the dialogues, didn't we?
So we did. We did.
How you connected with those people.
I would say for the first one, I relied very heavily on my board, only because I had been employed for about 4 months at that time. I had gone to school here, but then had taken the job for the state and hadn't been here for quite some time. So I relied really heavily on the board. Some people I already knew that needed to be involved. When you're thinking about your businesses, one of the things that we really have the luxury of having is a great downtown. And so we ended up bringing a couple of ladies from the downtown business. We brought a couple of people that were family-owned businesses, like multi-generational. And so we brought them in as far as the economy, but we also ended up having it at our local museum. And so the museum director, she was fantastic to have, and she added a wealth of knowledge and information that, you know, you might not have had. We also brought in Southeastern staff and faculty as well, because if we're talking about our economy, it really ties back to our education as well. Are we educating the workforce we want here, and are we also educating the workforce that we need here? So, you know, so many of these are integrated that you almost have the same people that could go into different sectors. But that's really how we did it, is we broke down those four voices and we started talking as a board of who should be involved, who should be invited. And then we started reaching out to those people to see if they would be able to come and attend.
Yeah, and one of the neat things was that even though we had three rounds, and so we had three sets of thought leaders, I don't think we had duplicates. Most people who attended each thought leader session were unique, right? So we had 24 times three thought leaders in the city mm-hmm. alone. And then we went on to the public, Would you say, in all fairness, that it was as easy to get the public to participate as it was inviting the thought leaders?
You know, in all fairness, I would say no, which really surprised me. But then again, it didn't whenever I was having to explain the process we were going through. I think we had to prove ourselves with the public. I think so many times they've heard, oh, yeah, that, you know, they're going to do this or you're going to do that. And then nothing really comes of it. So whenever, I know we're going to talk later about our early win, but when they started actually seeing the tangible that came, we got a lot more buy-in from the public. It was a little harder at first to try to get them involved.
Yeah. But what I remember is the very first one that we did was in your wonderful high school. Mm-hmm. And I remember how we were able to engage people there. And do you remember any of the particular, we could never predict who would turn up. But some of those people went on and became very integrated with the process. Yes. And in fact, one person I remember there in particular, you've already raised the topic of the early win, so let's not wait, let's talk about it. Tell us what the early win was, and do you remember who from that first public discussion has gone on and become a leader with that?
I do. So the first public discussion we had, like you mentioned, was at the high school, and we were talking just in small groups. And this gentleman named Tim Boatman, who is actually a professor at Southeastern, almost didn't come, I found out later, because he was working on his dissertation. And he just said, I really need a break. And I know this is going on, so I'm going to go to it. And we're so glad he did. Because at the previous dialogue, someone had said, I really wish we had a trail system. Well, Tim had also been thinking that, and he's a runner, and he had been starting to connect the smaller trails that we had in our community and going, oh, well, if you run from here, you can run on this sidewalk and get to this trail. And so he had kind of already started working on a trail plan and really stepped up and ended up leading that community initiative to create trails in our community. And from that dialogue, which was in June, we ended up writing for an assistance grant from the National Park Service for them. Let's plan the plan. You know, so often we get excited about an initiative and we just go out and do it and we don't think about the sustainability factor if it's going to be maintained. And so one of the first things we did was we want to make sure we're doing this right. You know, if we're trying to make change that will last for the generations to come, we want to make sure that it's done correctly. And so we ended up writing for an assistance grant from the National Park Service to do the plan and was awarded that in December. And May 5th, not even a year later, we opened the very first part of that trail. And it has now formed its own 501c3, which is the Durant Trails and Open Spaces, to start working on the NOAA-OCA, which in Choctaw means water walk, which is essentially what we're doing. We're following two major water sources in our community that connects our entire community. You know, and that is such a big win for us in more ways than one, because our health statistics we're falling because we don't have access to being physically active. It also connects those of in our community that are poverty stricken and maybe don't have access to transportation. It's allowing them to be able to safely walk from one side of the community. So it has been just amazing to see the community rally behind such a project. You know, the very first one that we did with the trail, we had four different individuals who donated their time and talent. So we had a concrete company here that they came and they poured concrete for the sidewalks. And then we had the city who did curb cuts, and, you know, a local paint store donated the paint to do the striping. And then you look and there's six people out with stencils that have been cut out by another company, you know, painting. And so it was so great to have that early win that helps our community, but also connects and gives an idea of what can happen when the community comes together and resources start to move.
And Kara, you were quite instrumental in that, in picking up, and this is a great example of the connections, because I, you know, when you wrote that grant, that was, I think, probably the first grant that you had ever written, right? And you were successful at that.
Yes.
And you have managed over other requirements of Imagine Durant to attract even legal advice and pro bono work that's really been wonderful. And you put in for another grant request that you also were successful at in regards to the trail, and that's related to the bridge, the pedestrian bridge. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that has, you've like scaled things up to a major degree, both of impact in the geography, including people, and in this case, the economy, the financing involved around this. Tell us a little bit about the bridge.
Absolutely. So the first trail that I mentioned that we opened is called the Schuler Loop. So we have multiple trails inside the larger Noah-Oka trail system.
Yeah.
And so the Schuler Loop is actually on Southeastern's campus. That's our university here. And it's named the Schuler Loop because it originally was a peach orchard owned by the Schuler family. So all of our trails have some kind of historical meaning because we don't want to forget our roots and our history and our ancestry as we're moving things forward in our community. We think that's incredibly important to remember the culture and the history that we've come from. The Schuler Loop, being on Southeastern's campus, we're working on connecting it to our downtown trail, but the one that you are mentioning is actually right to the side of it. So there is a protected crossway from Southeastern's campus that goes to their Visual and Performing Arts Center. Behind the Visual and Performing Arts Center is an abandoned railway station. And so whenever you're going on First, which is the street that you would have to cross to get to that, there is a bridge and it funnels. There is no shoulder. It's very scary. You see people walking on it, riding bikes, and you're just silently saying a prayer that no one gets seriously injured because there's no place for them to go if a car weren't paying attention. And when we had contacted ODOT, which is the Oklahoma Department of Transportation, to see what we could do about that bridge, if we could get it widened, because the bridge needed to be redone, they said, well, unfortunately, that bridge has already been approved for a certain design and it would take years to go back. So we just want to get a bridge that's not going to fall, basically. So that led us to the abandoned railway station where they have these huge concrete pillars that were still in existence from whenever the train used to go through. And we started working with some of our community members. It turns out the gentleman that owned the concrete that I mentioned earlier, the concrete plant, he owned part of that land in Southeastern on the other part. So this gentleman actually donated that land to Southeastern and to Imagine Durant to be able to start working on the bridge. The ODOT grant was actually written by two committee members from the Imagine Durant Trail. We had a meeting with the department commissioner for down here of transportation, and we were awarded the grant. It was a $395,000 grant, and it needs $99,000 of a match from the city. So the Oklahoma Trails and, or I'm sorry, the Durant Trails and Open Spaces community is now working on raising that other money. So our community is getting behind it, not just with their time and their talent, but also financially, because this trail that will now be created from the Rails to Trails will connect another trail, which is the Colton's Trail. Colton has, I could talk to you about this one for 20 minutes, so I won't, but it's a cross-country trail that's going in. So by the time that is connected and all the rest of them, we will have miles of trails that will attract people to our community and also help people that live here. So it's really great. It's a great initiative that we were able to start with.
And it seems to have captured the spirit of Imagine Durant as well as the spirit of the people. Because I remember, you know, when I came even before the first dialogues and did my first due diligence there, that was one of the main things that came up was people wanted a place, a safe place to walk and run. So they had trails on their minds then. And then when it came up in the first dialogue and it was identified as let's try and do something with this as an early win. And it just seems to have taken on its own energy and grown.
It has.
Something else that you did that I think also has long-term possibilities relates to the farmers market. Do you want to tell me how you got involved with that and how is that connected with something else that you mentioned with the Main Street?
Sure. So the first part of your question, really, it was just, again, in the dialogues, listening to what people want. You know, we were a little hesitant at first to start working on some of those initiatives because we didn't want to jump the gun, as I spoke earlier of. But these were things that we saw could be quick early wins the community was asking for. And so why wait, you know, 5 years to implement these things? So the farmers market, really, I went to a conference for farmers markets in Oklahoma to learn about the rules and regulations and how one needs to legally be set up. So I learned a lot about the different licensing that goes on for the different products that are grown. We created a partnership with the Durant Main Street because we knew we wanted to have it in our downtown area. It just when you see people outside, it creates this atmosphere. And so that was an opportunity to create even a better atmosphere for our downtown and encourage people after they visited the market to go shopping or eat at some of our local restaurants. And so that partnership was really great. It was a partnership with the city as well. The city ended up passing an ordinance that makes our farmers that are selling as vendors to only have to pay $25 before it was going to be $1,000. Oh my goodness. I mean, that, you know, that's something that a farmer is not going to be able to pay. And so we thought it was incredible that the city was willing to work with us to get something like this going, you know. And that again goes back to our obesity rates, our health rates. You know, people are needing access to fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables, and that's something they really didn't have. You know, we have a Walmart here that is your grocery store, and we have a couple of smaller grocery stores, but we're really considered a food desert because of where we're located at. And it's very funny because at one point in time, this was very rural, and that's all that you really saw were farmers. And so that was started in July of last year, and we tried to close it down four different times because we had about four volunteers running it, and the farmers in the community were like, oh, just please leave it going. It's so nice. So we ended up closing it at the end of October last year. Main Street has now won a state award for the farmers market. It's the crowning achievement of Durant. And so we go next month to receive that award. And coincidentally, May 6th, our market opens again, and people are already excited about it. And it's grown even more vendors this year and more people involved.
Yeah. You mentioned about the health of the community more than once. So sometimes when we think about these dialogues and these plans, and we're thinking the logical sequence that we go from visioning, and we did a lot of values assessment in Durant as well. And now we're in a new stage trying to do strategic planning. And I think you're moving into another area that requires some different roles of the ED. Can you tell me what are the three themes that you've developed for your vision, if you can remember those three areas?
Off the top of my head.
I'll help you because they were so wonderfully done with you and the others on the committee and the board without me there. So, you know, you always feel, I think, at least I do, when the group that you're working with has taken off and done the work better than you could do yourself, that it's really gratifying to see that it's really caught on. But you have talked a little bit about how this is a little bit more challenging for you because, again, this is a new area for you. So this conference is wanting to hear from people about the reality of doing this work and what are the early stages of learning like. So just tell me what it's like to move now from the visioning process into trying to get a strategy that we can actually implement.
Right. Well, I think one of the most important things is that it has to be a strategy that the community can understand. You know, sometimes whenever we're doing strategic planning work, we have to think at this very high level, and you have to bring that down to where people can understand it and grasp it and buy into it and get excited about the changes that are coming. One of the things that has kind of been my mantra, if you will, through this whole process is if it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you. If it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you. Because there has been such a learning and a growth deep with this. You know, when I came on, I had only had one other job out of college. Of course, I'd worked all through college and high school. But the job there was already had a lot of boundaries around it and a lot of, I guess organization. And I am very type A. I love organization. You know, I love to have to-do lists and know what I'm doing. And I walked into this role with literally just a desk. And I was like, okay, someone tell me what to do. And they're like, no, that's your job. You have to figure out the next steps. And so, you know, I'm very thankful for you and for Greg, who's our president and the person who actually started getting this going, because I had some framework to work with. But I think that in order for you to make lasting, impactful change for your community, you're going to have to go through some of those hoops first, and that you're going to have to be tested. Sometimes it's trial by fire and you might get a little bit burnt, but you know, you just get up and you keep going. Greg had told us in that last meeting when I was like, oh, I'm so frustrated with this process. He said, well, you're right where I want you then. So I'm at this new learning stage, and you know, I'm going to take what I learned from the last time and we're going to apply it to this time, and we're just going to keep working forward on it. But I think that one of the biggest takeaways for anyone going through this process is you have to realize that what you're doing is bigger than yourself. And yes, you are going to have frustrating days where you feel like, oh my gosh, is this even making an impact? And I can promise you it is. You know, every night when I go home to my husband and we're talking, he's like, what did you do today? And I get to tell him, oh, well, we started a farmer's market, or we started a trail, or we learned the three aspects that we're going to start focusing on as far as like learning for all of our citizens and a connected, healthy community and a vibrant and thriving community.
When
you get to start realizing that what you're doing is making an impact, and we don't have children yet, but knowing the fact that someday we will and we'll have grandchildren, what we're doing today matters. You know, there's an old Iroquois Confederation quote that I end every presentation with. I do that. It says, in every deliberation, we must consider the seventh generation. And if what we're working on right now is not going to impact them in a positive light, then it's more than likely going to impact them in a negative light. So anytime you're going through a process like this that's very challenging, it's worth it. So for those people that are going through that, I just encourage them to hang on and enjoy the ride and learn something new along the way.
Thank you, Kara. I think I couldn't ask you to end on a higher or better or more positive note than that. And I'd just like to thank you for joining me today in sharing what your journey has been with Imagine Durant, because, you know, the impact that you have made and that the organization is making is not only going out into this community, but you're becoming a model for other communities. Yeah. So I thank you so much for sharing today.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you, Marilyn.